Welcome to Conceptually Speaking, the show where we interview experts in a variety of fields to uncover the systems and patterns that help us to conceptualize and reconceptualize our world. I'm Julie Stern, founder of Education to Save the World and co-author of Learning That Transfers, Designing Curriculum for a Changing World.
And I'm Trevor Elio, English Language Arts Specialist at Ed to Save the World and co-author of Learning That Transfers. This podcast uses our mental model as a sense-making tool through acquiring, connecting, and transferring conceptual relationships to unlock new situations. Our guests identify 3 to 5 concepts at the heart of their field, and we discuss how those concepts play out in a variety of settings. We hope this podcast will inspire teachers and students to design creative solutions to complex problems and accelerate innovation in today's schools. You can find out more about our work at edtosavetheworld.com.
This episode explores the topic of student action with Dr. Mike Johnston. He has dedicated much of his time to not only ensuring students are properly prepared for the world's most pressing issues, but that they have the skills and desire to take action. To join me on this episode, we have LTT Science Lead Julia Briggs, who's also passionate about student action, chatting with me. Welcome, Julia.
Great to be here.
What was your key takeaway from our conversation, Julia?
So many, but I think right towards the end, I asked about advice and for inspiration for different teachers. And one thing that Mike said really hit home is less is more. You know, you don't need to have a million different ways of thinking about student action or to so many things in your toolbox. But let the values that you have as a school or as an individual drive what you want to do.
Definitely. So yeah, there were so many wisdom nuggets, and we kind of culminated them a bit at the end. But to me, the greatest thing that I'm taking away is his conversation about assessments and mental models around assessments.
The mental models that surround the word assessment, it's the first thing we have to engage in to actually create change. Because people always ask me, like, how can we change schools to be what it needs to be in this century? And I'm like, well, go to the bottom of the iceberg. We should do 2 things simultaneously. We need to tackle the mental models that surround, and we need to tackle the systems. And they ask me, well, Mike, where should we start? And I say, yes, do both. Do it at the same time.
We hope you enjoy the conversation. This episode, LTT Science Lead Julia Briggs and I are excited to unpack the topic of student action with Dr. Mike Johnston. Welcome, Mike.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Can we start with you telling us a bit about who you are and how you became interested in student action?
Absolutely. I consider myself to be a lifelong learner and educator who along the path didn't realize many years ago that I was kind of coercing students into action in the wrong way, more of indoctrination and, ooh, this is scary. And then I realized, you know what? There's so much opportunity to get to the best 2 outcomes I think are possible in school, which is deep personalized learning and making a better world at the same time. So I've been on that journey for over 20 years.
Excellent. Love that. And so we always ask our guests to identify 3 to 5 words that sort of are at the core. You are an expert in systems thinking, in humane education, in so many different aspects. So imagine it was hard. Was it hard first before I reveal the words? Was it hard for you to pick your 3 to 5 words?
It was extremely difficult. but what I consider myself, one of my skills I believe I have is to create simplicity from complexity. So it's actually really good, I think, for people to go through that process to say, okay, and groups of 3 are always ideal, as we know in frameworks.
That's right. Okay, so the words are complexity, sustainability, systems, and authentic assessment. So let's just sort of unpack each of those. Do you want to start with complexity?
Yeah, I wasn't sure whether to put that word because it's so intrinsically connected with systems and sustainability, but I think it's important to unpack them separately to actually reveal the connection. So I wanted to start with complexity because I truly, truly believe, and through all the research I've done and through my PhD is in organizational systems. So I have this dream that in schools, when students of whatever age, whether they're 5 or whether they're 16, when they see and encounter complex things, that they don't have a reaction of being overwhelmed. And that's why I have this dream that they would see complex things and get excited with complexity and actually look at it and go, ooh, I can figure this out. And that's why I wanted to start with the word complexity, because I think we are all born to tackle complexity, dig into complexity. We do it right from the moment that we enter this world, and we just need to continue to foster that. And what better place than schools? Mm-hmm. So that's why I wanted to start with the word complexity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that. Yeah.
It reminds me of like the Rubik's Cube, you know, like the kids play with things that are complex, like just for fun. So that's just where my brain went. Julia, where'd your brain go whenever he said that?
Well, we've talked about complexity a lot in the last year. And it's kind of the concept of the 21st century. We're trying to teach for complexity. And the work that we do with learning transfer is designed so that we can help our young people tackle that complexity. And actually something that you said at the beginning really resonated with me, this coercion of learning or the coercion of trying to get kids to do something. And that was really how I started my career. How do I trick kids into this activity of learning? And I read on your website somewhere buried in there that you're teaching for the skill and desire to make change in the world. And you can teach the skills, like I know how to do the ironing, doesn't mean that I want to do the ironing, but how do we get that desire piece to mix with the skills so that we can change the world and make the world a better place? Wonder what your thoughts are on that piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, that's my mission in life. That's to engage students in that complexity and that passion work. And I sit on the fence a little bit with it, because there's no black and white here. Like with everything, this is a yes and, right? There's no either or with this kind of work. And so I find that I'm always walking the line between people ask me, hey, Mike, how do you get students to do this authentic action? Do you push it at them and then they experience it and they have a fundamental change as they experience it? Or do you invite them to it and they actually undergo and control more? And my answer always is yes. And it depends on it depends on the kid. It depends on where they are, because in my experience, I'll often get the question, for example, about service learning programs, because I help people set up service learning programs in all different schools around the world. And they say, okay, should we have required hours for service learning? And again, the answer isn't yes or no. Ideally, no. Ideally, people would be intrinsically motivated to change the world and do great things and help people and help the environment. But actually, in some cases, you have to be the person who puts that opportunity in front of them and says, you know what, let's go do this in our community. And they don't know that feeling of what that feeling is like to do something for someone else or for the world or for whatever it is that they're trying to help until they actually experience it. Mm-hmm. So you kind of got to walk the line between both. Mm-hmm. So I've spent, you know, over 20 years in my career helping people do that. And it's different every time, as with any education.
Yeah, you
personalize it.
Reminded me of when I was director of public policy at like a charter school that was trying to, you know, the mission was to get these young people to be civically engaged. And we came up with this little cycle of understand, act, believe, because we wanted them to have some understanding of the public policy process before they went and did something. And then when they did something, usually a service project, then that's the catalyst for them to feel empowered, for them to feel like their voice mattered. So as you were saying that, it just reminded me, it's been a long time since I thought about that. And also as you were talking about the word complexity, I was thinking about, okay, student action. We first didn't unpack that. We sort of assumed all of our listeners know what student action means, but maybe we do need to unpack that. Yeah. And the relationship between, you used, I think, maybe the word brainwashing or mind control, or I don't know, something like that in the very beginning of this related to coercion of like, you just, you know, you're Canadian and you live in Germany, but in the United States, we have a lot happening right now around equity and diversity and critical race theory and people very worried. And I think in some ways, even though a lot of it I think is super misguided and misunderstood, there is some value to teachers should not put their values on kids. So I wonder if the word complexity sort of underpinning whatever it is we want students to take action on, knowing that diversity, climate change, poverty, economics, whatever the kids are doing a project on or some sort of student action on is most likely extraordinarily complex. So I sort of made that connection. Is that kind of where you were going with that as well?
Absolutely. And the world getting more complex. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when we talk student action, you know, I look at the work that we're doing with the ACT model, right? Mm-hmm. If they're actually going to transfer, mm-hmm. there has to be some kind of authentic, you know, I don't love the word action, but people get it. So it's like, okay, you take action, you actually do something with the learning that you have acquired, and now you've made these connections. And so now let's do this in a context that matters to me. So I just think you're spot on with the idea that we want students to be able to understand this complexity, which is why, you know, one of my favorite quotes from Eric Berlow, simplicity yeah. is often just on the other side of complexity. And so I believe that we actually have to teach students how to get there. And this kind of dovetails into my second word, systems, because I was so upset that I didn't get introduced to formal systems thinking, systems application until my later graduate work. And I was thinking to myself, where was that when I was 11? Why wasn't somebody helping me understand the world in that way? And so simplicity being, you know, just on the other side of complexity, if we can have students understand what it means to be in the balcony and look at the whole thing and all the moving parts and how they connect and on the dance floor, mm-hmm. and how to go in between those two constantly, then actually when they are taking action, less unintended consequences and more authentic, it'll actually mean something and they'll learn a ton doing it. So yeah, that's, I'm with you. It's the same kind of connection for me where authentic action, you know, it breaks my heart a little bit that in a lot of places, unfortunately, students have to take action outside of curriculum. What we deem as curriculum. It's like, okay, if I'm going to take action or I'm part of a service group or I'm doing something, I'm working with Amnesty International, whatever it might be. Oh, that's a club and that's an outside of my school day thing. And I just think that is a terrible shame. We this learning could be done during the day in so many ways. I mean, right, Julia, you're a science teacher. This is perfect fodder for transfer of those science concepts, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm very lucky. I work in an international school and I have a lot of freedom within my curriculum design. And I love that. But actually going back to something that you just said, I had the same experience with this systems thinking piece. Like I'm studying right now and I just came across Peter Senge's work. And I was like, how do I only just know this about systems and systems thinking and how pieces work together? And I totally agree that it doesn't have to be the curriculum and then what I want the students to really achieve in the world and make a huge difference. That can be totally integrated and a part of what I do every day. And that would help my students understand the interrelated nature of the world. And not just science happens at period one on a Thursday. And then I go and do my features sustainability club later. And a big shift that I've had recently in the last few years of teaching is that I have my curriculum, and then outside of the curriculum, I'm planning for projects or things that are going to more focus on student action. But actually, the two don't need to be separate. So I'm wondering if you have any examples of how teachers can better integrate within the bounds of their curriculum, these opportunities for student action?
I think it really varies depending on what age group you're working in. So when you're working with different age groups, for example, we're a PYP school at Frankfurt International School, and the inquiry units are absolutely set up to be able to run that whole cycle of inquiry, including the action, including doing something authentic. So if you're working with, you know, 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds, it's already set up. And if you're not a PYP school, there's nobody stopping you from doing authentic inquiry and actually doing, you know, digging into the important concepts and connecting and transferring. And, you know, if there's one piece of advice that I could give, if you're working with that age, slow down. Depth over breadth. Don't try and do 6 to 8 units over the year. Do 3, maybe 4, and actually go deeper, because again, a lot of the enemy to authentic student action is time. It's like, we don't have time, or we get to the end of what we're learning about. We've had this wonderful inquiry unit on climate and how the world works and the science behind it and the geography behind it and all these things. And then we're like, oh, we only have 1 week left. What should we do? It's like, okay. That kind of seems not super authentic. So I would say if you're working with that age group, inquiry units are your fodder. Go for it, right? And even let them follow these lines of taking action throughout the whole year as underlying to the other concepts and things you're working on as a school. Middle schools have a great opportunity to connect all these things, because I like to say middle schoolers, I love their delusional confidence. It's so fantastic. I was a middle school principal for years, and you can take that age group and help them to do these authentic projects in so many creative ways, because you don't necessarily have the pressure that you do in a high school to follow a dedicated pathway of curriculum, whether you're IB diploma or AP or A levels or whatever it is that you are. So I would say you just have to get creative to do this, depending on what age group that you work in. For example, at Frankfurt International School, we started this year the Changemaker program. Mm. And the Changemaker program started as a leadership program. And you kind of have to be the sustainability chameleon. You got to just name it what people need to hear in order to get them to do authentic things. And for this leadership program, the students renamed it Changemakers once they got into it, because actually what we're trying to do is change the world. Mm. And for the younger students in grade 4 and 5 who are in the program, they're doing quite different things than the 11th graders, right? But actually they stay in touch with each other on
That's awesome.
And the plan is that it starts to be embedded in their curricular day. Mm. They're already starting to make those connections, but there's so many creative ways to do it. And Julia, I would say, depending on the context of your school, get a group sitting down and chewing through the possibilities. There are lots of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One thing that I was thinking about when you said sort of less units over the course of a year, sort of an epiphany that I had that's at some point in the last year that's related to once I was in actually a session with you doing some coaching with the school where you work that happens to be a partner school of ours. And you brought up the iceberg visual. And even though this is an audio podcast, I wonder if you could describe the iceberg. I think it's just so nice for when you both said you haven't heard of systems theory until you're older, there may be some listeners who might be like, who the heck is Peter Senge? And so I wonder if you could just sort of walk people through the iceberg, because to me, there's often a misunderstanding, especially with secondary teachers, about the word depth. And the aha that I had was, oh, you think all the facts about World War II is depth. And I don't think that all the facts about World War II is not depth. The concepts about World War II, alliances, sovereignty, invasion, war, leadership, isolation, involvement, defending democracy, totalitarianism, that's depth. And you can do a unit on basically like war, where you're studying lots of different wars. And some teachers might see that as surface. But if they spend, you know, 8 weeks on World War II, they see that as depth. And I'm like, oh, let's kind of wrap this around and think about it differently. And I think your iceberg visual is a really nice way to get at that. So I don't know if you could describe it in a way for audio purposes.
Sure. Yeah. I got to say, when I started to work in systems and was introduced to the work of Danella Meadows and Peter Senge and, you know, the Learning Exchange, Waters Foundation out of the States, mm-hmm. doing great mm-hmm. systems thinking for schools. It was a game changer for me to actually apply these tools. Mm-hmm. So I actually got the opportunity to become a member of Compass Education. Mm-hmm. And Compass Education is a group trying to create a sustainable future through systems thinking and using these tools and frameworks to actually tackle complexity. So it fits in with all of my right. words. But when I started to use the tools, like the Compass is a tool from Alan Atkinson, the Iceberg is a tool. And I kind of describe it this way. If you were a plumber, right, and you showed up at a house, and I always say this to the students who are becoming change makers. I'm like, okay, so what would you do when you show up at that house? And they said, well, you assess the problem. I'm like, yeah, you do. How do you do that? Or do you just pull out of the van? Do you just pull a wrench out of the van and go in the house and say, I'm here to fix it? And I said, no, you don't do that. How do you know what tool to pull out of the toolbox? Well, you got the theory behind plumbing. Then you're an apprentice and you practice and you have mentors and you learn about these things so that by the time you are experienced, you come in and you assess the whole system. What's going on? Where's this leak coming from? Is it internal? Is it external? Is it connected to this? Is it connected to this? Then you know what tool to pull out of the toolbox. The iceberg is just a tool you can pull out of the toolbox. And people always ask me, they're like, what systems tools do you espouse, Mike? And what is it that kind of your brain as you're making all these connections? And I say, well, I'm always using the iceberg in my brain. I'm always using the compass in my brain. I'm always using systems mapping. I'm always using causal connection and causal loop diagramming and that kind of thing. Because I've practiced with it so much, it's happening in my brain all the time. So the iceberg, I love it because you only see, you know, when we look at an iceberg, we only see a small percentage. And that percentage that we see above the water is often just the events. So when we're looking at something, for example, at a school, it's like, okay, there's a lot of garbage in the cafeteria. Okay, that is an event. Kids are leaving garbage in the cafeteria. And to give our listeners a visual, if you want to work with students with this tool, it's gold. Because most of the time, unfortunately, people just do the top part. So like, okay, let's do something about the garbage. Let's put more garbage cans. Let's put more teachers on duty. Let's put posters up. Let's have an assembly that shows the cleaner crying because they're so sad they have to clean up after these spoiled kids. Like there's all these ideas of action that people go through. And really they are unintended consequences. They are not, they're just the surface stuff. So that's why I love the iceberg, because underneath that is understanding the patterns of behavior. You do the behavior over time. And students really grasp onto that layer of the iceberg just underneath the events, where it's like, what's been happening in the past? What's happening right now? What would we like to see happen? And then you dig one layer deeper in the iceberg, and it's understanding the systems. If you don't understand how these things connect and work, you have no chance solving this issue. And then you go one deeper, and it's mental models and beliefs. What are people thinking, which is actually the most important. And it's the one that's hardest to see, but the great complexity thinkers of the world can surface the mental models, make them visual, surface the systems and make them visual, understand the patterns of behavior to therefore change the events. And that's the order that they work in. And unfortunately, a lot of people just work on the surface. So for that cafeteria example, people just stay on that surface. But, mm-hmm. you know, I worked with a group of students on that exact issue with the iceberg. Mm-hmm. What did they decide to do? They actually decided to do workshops for parents in the high school just before their kids were going off to college and university. They wanted to call the workshop, "You're Raising a Slob." Now that wasn't very invitational.
No.
So they called it life skills.
Life right? skills.
And they ran a workshop. They were in a workshop at a parent event saying, you know, if they don't know how to do their laundry and clean up after themselves and do these kind of things, what's going to happen when nobody's around to do it mm-hmm, for them? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it was very invitational and started a whole new conversation. So that's why I like the iceberg and tools like that. It actually leads to deeper understanding and deeper actions that actually matter.
Man, that hit too close to home, Mike, because this morning with my 5 and 7 year old, to get them out the door to go to summer camp, I was just like, dudes, this is not working. And so when you started sharing that cafeteria example, I was like, oh, you know what's underneath the iceberg? The parents, because it's so much faster for me to clear the table, for me to put on their socks, for me to, you know, it's faster at first. And so we often, busy parents, we fall into this category of, I'm one of them, of just doing it for them. And then all of a sudden your kids are, well, mine are 5 and 7, but your kids, so hopefully mine don't become teenagers and they're still doing it. But yeah, as soon as you were sharing that trash example, I was like, oh, that what's below the iceberg is the parent behavior for sure.
And Julia, you see it in international schools, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of benefits, but yes, I definitely see that. But as you were speaking, I definitely was thinking that's so true. It's not just about fixing the problem, the symptoms of the problem. It's about going deeper and looking at the human behavior behind it. And that reminds me a lot of Dustin Erdős and Susan Hanisch and the work that they do around pro-social behaviors and evolutionary thinking about human behavior. Mm-hmm. And it all connects, like everything is connected and everything needs to be considered in the system. But also that piece that you mentioned about the parents and the community, it's about reconceptualizing schools. It's not just about, I'm the teacher, here are the students, here's my administration. These kids have parents and families, they belong to a community beyond the school, part of the school, a society. And throughout my career, I've always been moving towards this space where I don't just necessarily want to interact with one student. I want to have an impact on the whole community. And I want that child to feel empowered to also have an impact on the whole community, maybe society, maybe the world. And I love that notion of the schools within the community. And I know that that's something that you touch on in some of the work that you share on your website. And I just wonder if you could share a little bit more about that. I'm adding a concept to your list. So I apologize for that. But I think it ties in because it's about systems. It's about complexity and it's about sustainability, because without taking into consideration the community, it won't be a sustainable system.
Well, what starts to happen, I think, is people believe that these are counterpoints. It's kind of like with the concept of sustainability. People believe that you have to sacrifice environment or economy or society or well-being. Something's got to be sacrificed to do well in another area. It's not true. That's a mental model. That's a fallacy. And it's a fallacy that we have to hit on the head, because there are lots of ways to do this. But you're right. The only way to do that is to have the whole community conversation. I truly believe we're not here to tell kids what to think. We're here to help them to learn how to think. And if we help them learn how to think, what's going to happen is we invite the parents into that conversation, and we're going to have some good, rich conversations. You know, it's like Brené Brown says, you got to be willing to rumble, right? And so everybody's got to be able to get in the rumble. And in order to do that, you create the safe space to actually have meaningful conversations around equity, justice, belonging, whatever it might be, and then be able to have the students be ideally leading that. Because if they're leading that, then it is truly invitational for all stakeholders to get involved. And in our Changemaker program, it made me so proud. 2 weeks ago, when we were doing our final year reflection before taking a little break over the summer, one of the students said, what I love most about this is I am learning alongside the adults. We're learning together. And I was thinking, oh, you know what? We need to cascade this into when we host our Changemaker conference next March, we're going to host at Frankfurt International School. We need parents in that conversation. We need community mentors in that conversation. We need And then we really do have the possibility for greater impact. Mm-hmm. So I completely agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Love that. Reminds me of Sugata Mitra said at a conference about a year ago, it was in the midst of COVID lockdown. He says, what if instead of building school on established knowledge that humans have already discovered, what if we build school on questions that humanity hasn't solved? And I was like, breach. Imagine the shift. I totally agree that that's where we go. And we don't throw out, back to your false dichotomy idea, we don't throw out the established knowledge. We put these questions in front of students and we use the established knowledge to solve currently not yet solved dilemma. And so I wonder if that sort of brings to your other concept of sustainability. Often people's brains, when they hear the word sustainability, they think climate change. I'm inferring that you have a more expansive sort of explanation definition of that word. So let me not assume and just ask you, what does sustainability mean to you?
Yeah, it's always the first question I ask when I run workshops on sustainability and systems. And what's amazing, when you ask people that and you get the commonalities and the differences, it's all over the place. Like people, it's the one of the challenges of sustainability is it's super complex. Mm-hmm. So then some people check out on it. Mm-hmm. And for other people, it's been kidnapped by the keen greeners and tree huggers. And, you know, I'm a tree hugger myself. I consider myself to be, but unfortunately, sometimes people are super counterproductive for what they actually want. So my bigger understanding of sustainability came from my work with Alan Atkinson and Compass Education. And I got to say, the compass as a tool, it's a super easy tool. North, east, south, west, right? North is nature, east is economy, south is society, west is well-being. And we put this super simple systems tool. It's just a system, right? It's in the toolbox. Just bring it out of the toolbox when you need. You put it in front of people and they very easily can come up with causes and effects of these multiple systems conditions. So sustainability to me is knowing that it's multiple systems conditions all simultaneously dancing together. You know, and I love Danilo Meadows saying, you know what, we should all be learning how to dance with the system. And so sustainability to me is understanding that all these systems conditions, right, are intertwined. And yes, that's complex, but that's also exciting. So I work a lot with people unpacking those systems conditions to say, it's okay to be an expert on well-being. The world needs them. It's okay to be an expert on environment and ecology. The world needs those people, but those people can't work in isolation. One of the most glaring things when you use the compass as a tool is most of the time, the quadrant that is the emptiest is economy. And it's because people don't perceive they understand how the economy works. So they don't actually put much about it. And like, it's a major system that is so important for us to understand, but we don't dig into it deep enough or we learn the linear economy and that's it. And we're learning this limited history of how a linear economy works when we have much better possibilities with circular economies and regenerative processes that, you know, back to what I said, that these things are not counter, they're not battling with each other, at least they shouldn't be, but people think they are. So that's why, you know, sustainability excites me. I love helping to get people to that bigger understanding of sustainability and then saying, okay, now what are you going to do about it? You know, look at the SDGs, 16 super complex, intertwined, massive things. The 17th is working together to make them all happen. So are we okay with digging into all those? Is that too much for people? And people are like, oh, no, it's too much. It's not achievable. Goal number one is end poverty for all people. Mm-hmm. And I say to people, well, of course, that's what we should be shooting for.
Right.
Is that going to happen by 2030? No, doesn't mean we shouldn't be aiming at it.
Wow.
You know, it's the enemy of the SMART goals. I'm not a big SMART goal fan. I'm more of a dumb goal fan.
What does that stand for?
The D in dumb goal is dream.
It's
like you're aiming for something bigger. And then, as I said, you can be on the balcony and you can be on the dance floor and you can be in between. This is what we should be helping kids do.
Love that. And you just reminded me of, and I love that analogy of dance floor and balcony, because when I got my first vaccine, the way in which they did it in Fairfax County, Virginia, is everybody had to go to, not everybody, but they had like two centers. And this is, I mean, there's probably 4 million people in Fairfax County. So it's a huge populated area. And they, it was like a concert. And I got emotional. I really did. I'm not like a terribly emotional, like sentimental kind of person. And I was just like, it was incredible. And it made me think, it was like, I was on the dance floor, right? Like getting my vaccine, but it, I went up in that moment. I went into the, onto the balcony and I just said, if humans put their mind to something, look at what we can do. People were kind. People were letting cars, were letting other cars go in front of them. In Northern Virginia, for listeners who don't know, this is not normal behavior. This is like a very kind of doggy dog culture here and outside of Washington, D.C. And so people were waving to each other. People were letting each other go front, go first. The volunteers had, it was a huge line, but it went really fast. And the volunteers had little speakers where they had music playing. They had stickers on the ground of like how far to stand away from people. It was a well, there were probably 100 some odd people actually giving the jab. And I asked the lady, she was like, do you have any questions about the vaccine? And I was like, how many people do you guys vaccine a day? And she was like, we're about 5,000 a day. In that one center, there's space for you to sit and, you know, wait and make sure you knew you didn't have any reactions. They had water. They had, I mean, it was incredible. And it just made me think, man, if humans put their mind to something, what we can achieve. And that gives me hope for all the things that we need to tackle right now. It definitely gives me hope for if we could put our minds to it, we can do it. And I think, I hope that many people had a similar reaction to COVID and how hard we worked on the vaccine and getting it out and how people came together, how schools and gosh, God bless teachers. Julia's a teacher. All the things, you're an administrator, Mike. I don't even know how you did it, but all the things that that schools did to make this year as successful as possible. It's inspiring. I really think that's awesome. Getting to student action, your last word there, or actually not student action is your topic, getting to authentic assessments. Ooh. So you said performance or authentic assessment. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna ask you about that word assessment because that is the most contentious topic in education. And so can you tell us a little bit about what authentic assessment means to you?
Yeah, so I'm gonna go back to the iceberg and go down to the bottom of the iceberg in mental models and beliefs. The mental models that surround the word assessment, it's the first thing we have to engage in to actually create change. Because people always ask me, like, how can we change schools to be what it needs to be in this century? And I'm like, well, go to the bottom of the iceberg. We should do two things simultaneously. We need to tackle the mental models that surround, and we need to tackle the systems. And they ask me, well, Mike, where should we start? And I say, yes, do both. Do it at the same time. Because for example, if you're going to change the system, okay, you're going to change the grading system, for example, and people's mental models are still fixed on their idea of assessment or the need for very traditional approaches towards assessment, you're in for a battle. Your system's probably going to collapse, your new one, and you're in for heartache. Whereas you also can't sit forever trying to alter mental models and shift mental models while no action is happening with the system. So you're kind of caught in between. So when I say assessment, that's the biggest thing. I mean, assessing whether a student has learned something, you couldn't have a bigger bucket. Like we are talking, are we assessing whether they know something? Are we assessing whether they understand something? Is it a concept? Are we assessing whether they can do something? There's so many things that could be assessed. I just think we need to be very deliberate. And when it comes to student action, what would we actually want to assess? I can tell you what we shouldn't assess. The poster and the colors on the poster and the title and the PowerPoint slides and the, you know, unless you're specifically looking at the ability to present complex ideas in a succinct way in a presentation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a great thing to assess, but right? Unfortunately, we have this culminating presentation. It happens. That's it. It's like, wait a second, they never actually got to practice it, do it, get feedback on it, do it again, do it again, do it again, do it again. And then, you know, the audience, the authentic audience changes each time. So when I say performance assessment and authentic assessment, that's what I mean. And I truly believe there's no better way to get to these skills and these concepts than authentic action. When they're actually doing something that matters, whether they are writing a letter to a local politician, would you rather them in class write a letter to an arbitrary person because they needed to learn the skill of letter writing? Or would you actually have them write a letter about the rules on dogs because they're in third grade and they love dogs, about the dogs at the local park because they actually want to change the rules because they think it would be better for their town? You know what? I want them writing to their local politicians. That's to me where the authenticity comes from. And people always ask me, their assumption about me is that I'm an educational anarchist.
Oh,
right. It's like,
that's an extreme word.
Everything should be project-based and everything should be total inquiry, student-led. And I'm like, no, is it in the end of the day, the foundations of literacy and the foundations of numeracy are so important. Because as we build all these concepts, yes, we want them to connect the dots. But what if they don't have any dots to connect?
Yeah. And what you're saying here about like changing the mental models resonates with me so much. It's not about, okay, let's just decide what the assessment is. It's everything around that. What do we think about the assessment? What are our values around assessment? And I always think that in my experience with education, even at school myself, there was this shift to are we measuring what we value, or are we valuing what we can measure? And that's kind of driven a lot of the systems that we have around assessment, and I see it day in, day out in my work. You've mentioned a lot of great examples, sustainable development goals, huge source of inspiration, writing a letter to a local politician or a change maker within the community. If I'm a teacher, I am a teacher, but if I'm a teacher in a classroom who is lacking inspiration, not sure where to go to for ideas, where would you suggest they go? What kind of areas of inspiration would you recommend?
Yeah, there are lots of them out there. The thing that gives me great hope is the more I have these conversations and work with people around the world, there's lots of people working towards this, like you guys are working towards the same goal, and it's so lovely. I would say align yourself with the groups of people who have similar passions. Like, for example, we started last week a level one Compass education course on sustainability and systems thinking online. Mm-hmm. Join a cohort of 20 people and do that. And I promise you, it'll be a game changer for both your pedagogy and also your mental model towards systems and sustainability. Join the courses with Julie and the team, right? That's been a game changer for our teachers. To jump in those and have a collective experience and understand what it actually might mean to connect and to transfer and to have kids doing authentic things that matter in the world. I would say one of the problems that exists is there's actually too many options.
Yeah, there's and, a lot.
You
yeah.
You as a school just have to focus and say, here's what matters to us. At Frankfurt International School, we're focusing on rock solid literacy, rock solid numeracy, amazing inquiry. Who are we linking to those things? Well, we're linking to the people that we think do those things the best. That's why we work with Julie and the team, right? We work with you guys because we believe that helps the inquiry and helps us do the things we want. They take Compass courses to get the actual specific systems tools. They're just love building that. The toolbox. And you just take those pieces. And when you have a collection of people within your school who mm-hmm. are all having these collective experiences, it's a game changer.
That's right. That's right. Love that. Love that. That was definitely something that we didn't expect from our courses, was that when schools take them together, it creates this, even though they're totally, for the most part, asynchronous. And, you know, we've got teachers from all over the world, but it definitely can get this little vibe going within the school. And so I love that as like advice, yeah. just to find one or two other teachers at your school. So if we probably have listeners where their school administration is not like you sort of taking this route, but we definitely have a lot of teachers in our courses who have one other, they grab one other teacher at their school who can, they can talk about this in person, in the flesh, which I think is really nice. That was a great question, Julia. And so you sort of got towards this last question. We always ask our guests to share, where can people find you? So Julia mentioned your website a bit. I know you're on Twitter. So where can people find you if they want to learn more, if they want to hear more about Compass, all of those things?
Yeah. And now that I have a break, I'm in quarantine at the moment. I'm going to do some more writing on my blog.
Awesome.
On at johnstonmike.com. Mm-hmm. People can find the work, for example, the Changemaker work. We're telling the whole story mm-hmm. as we go on there. You can find me aligned with compasseducation.org. You can find me at Frankfurt International School as the assistant head with an amazing group of people working mm-hmm. towards creating the future that we're describing. Mm-hmm. JohnstonMike34 on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Choose your avenue.
Love it. Love it. There's a lot of places that people can find you. So any final thoughts that you want to share about student action? Any other sort of advice that you want to impart on our listeners?
Maybe just to end with the fact to be vulnerable. Mm. You know, as you work towards student action and you're tackling these complex issues, you don't have to be the expert.
I love it.
You don't need to be the expert on the content. You don't need to be the conceptual expert. Mm-hmm. Just jump right in and learn right alongside, because it's an amazing journey and it will take you places you never thought you could go with students.
Love that. Such excellent advice. And I think you're saying about, I wrote this down, our mental models around assessment are the, I can't remember exactly how you said it, but that has got to change. And I just love that. And I think you shared so much wisdom. That especially is a mental model that a lot of teachers hold, is that I have to know things before students. If they read a novel, I feel like I have to read it first. I have teachers tell me that, and I'm like, no, you don't. Have a kid tell you about the novel. So I think that's great advice, is you don't have to know everything about the situation, the issue that students might want to take action on and learn alongside them. Super, super great advice. Wonderful. Well, I had such a good time. Thank you so much for joining us. Julia, you have any final thoughts or questions or comments that you want to share?
No, I love that. And I think that the piece of advice of simplifying mm-hmm. for me is what mm-hmm. I'm going to take away. You don't have to look in 1,000 different places and have 1,000 different tools, but it starts from your values and what you mm-hmm. really care about. And then let that drive what action you mm-hmm. plan for. Mm-hmm.
One more nugget is teaching the students how to think, not what to think. So nice. Love that. So thank you, Mike. It was lovely. And definitely people reach out to him or follow him on Twitter and follow along with this journey of the change makers. I can't wait to see more of it at Frankfurt International School. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Conceptually Speaking. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and are coming away with a stronger grasp of the concepts and mental models that help us understand our world. If you like this podcast, feel free to like, comment, or subscribe on your favorite platform. If you want to learn more or get involved, check out our website at edtosavetheworld.com and join our Facebook group, Learning That Transfers.